Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we're asking the question today, are men and women different at your workplace? And is there an asset to estrogen ratio? And how should the rules of the workplace change to accommodate both men and women? We will have, after the news, Katty Kay from the BBC and Claire Shipman from ABC News. They've written a book together called Womenomics, and one of the things they assert is that there is an asset to estrogen ratio. That is, businesses who have women in leadership positions tend to do better. But they also say men and women are different in the workplace. So we're asking that question of you. Post to our website at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Are men and women different at your workplace? And is there an asset to estrogen ratio? Post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And we'll talk to Katty Kay and Claire Shipman after the news at the top of the hour. Now, yesterday at this time, we had Noam Chomsky on the show for the 40th anniversary of his seminal work, American Power and the New Mandarins, about the Vietnam War and intellectuals in 1969. Well, also 40 years ago, a very different intellectual political voice burst upon the scene as well. Rick Brookhiser, long considered the heir apparent to William Buckley at National Review, published his first National Review article. Rick was 14 years old at the time. He did not go on to inherit the reins at National Review, but has had a very successful career as a political commentator, PBS host, and historian. He even shows up quite a bit on the Colbert Report. And some of you will remember he used to be a regular monthly guest talking politics on the Leonard Lopate Show. Now Rick Brookhiser has a memoir called Right Time, Coming of Age with William Buckley Jr. and the Conservative Movement. Hi, Rick. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me. It's right time, right place.
Right time, right place. I'm sorry.
Both the time and the place. They seemed right.
So the time is the 60s. You're growing up as a baby boomer. Other kids are protesting for civil rights and against the Vietnam War. And you're drawn to William F. Buckley. Where was that and how did it happen?
Well, I grew up in a suburb of Rochester, New York, upstate, called Irondequoit. And I went to the local public high school. And in October of 1969, there was a Vietnam War moratorium. This was a national event. It was mostly on college campuses, and there were boycotts of classes and teach-ins and protests and whatnot. And as this was approaching, some kids in my high school decided to imitate it. And my brother's 6 years older than I was. He was off at college. I wrote him a letter describing what went on in my high school, and I thought these kids were wrong on the issue of the Vietnam War, and I also thought they were phony radicals. They were saying, you know, we're out there, we're really doing this, but they were just imitating their elders. So my brother writes back and says, I like that letter. And my father said, why don't you send it to National Review? No one in my family knew anything about journalism. We didn't practice it. We didn't know any journalists. I took Dear Bob off the letter. I sent it off. And then some months later, I get a letter back saying, we've got your article. We're going to publish it. And then when it came out, it turned out to be the cover story.
Huh.
And then the third surprise was I got a check for $180. I was so clueless, I didn't know you got paid for this kind of thing.
Was the letter from Buckley himself?
The letter was from the assistant managing editor, a man named Chris Simons, and he'd taken some months to answer because he said it had gotten lost on his desk. And I would soon realize that is a typical feature of journalism.
No way
we keep our offices.
Right. I mean, you were a perfect – I'm not saying the letter and the article weren't good – but you were a perfect tool for them in the sense that, aha, if this was a youth movement against the war, here they had a 14-year-old on their side.
Well, sure. This was, look, a 14-year-old speaks out, you know, for our position. And, in fact, a few years later, when Richard Nixon ran against George McGovern and 18-year-olds got the right to vote for the first time, an awful lot of them voted for Richard Nixon.
Yep.
So there was some truth to it.
Did you read Noam Chomsky's American Power and the New Mandarins in 1969?
No, I didn't. But what I had read was Miami and the Siege of Chicago by Norman Mailer, which was his coverage of the 68 election. I mean, it was part of my my interest in politics. Politics was my sports. In the sense of, you know, a body of knowledge with winners and losers and statistics and something you could track and follow. But it was also, you know, the 60s were also a very disturbing and vivid time, and you had to take an interest in what was going on because there was so much momentous stuff that was going on.
So having had
double attraction,
having had Chomsky yesterday talking about 69 and you here today talking about Buckley in 69, guess what we were able to dredge up? A clip of William F. Buckley Jr. with Noam Chomsky on Firing Line.
Oh, sure.
About,
sure, that's probably on YouTube, isn't it?
It is on YouTube from 1969. Let's listen.
I rejoice in your disposition to argue the Vietnam question, especially when I recognize what an act of self-control this must involve.
It does.
Sure.
It really does.
Sure.
I mean, I think that this is the kind of issue where...
You're doing very well.
Sometimes I lose my temper. Maybe not tonight.
Maybe not tonight. Because if you would, I'd smash you in the goddamn face. you say in your book...
Good reason for not losing.
So, wow, that was 1969. No, and, of course, from William Buckley's Firing Line. No conservative... I mean, you know, O'Reilly does not go on television today and tell somebody that he's going to smash him in his goddamn face.
Well, now that he was playing off an encounter he'd had the year before with Gore Vidal covering the Democratic convention, and they got into a real fight and, you know, a real argument, and you know, Vidal called Buckley a Nazi, and Buckley said, "I'll smash you in your goddamn face." He was truly angry then. One of the few times he ever lost his cool. But I think another thing that's interesting about that clip, and one of the attractions of Bill, he was very aggressive, very confrontational, but he had a one-hour show on television, and he would let the other person say what it was he or she wanted to say. And this, you know, you think of media now and how chopped up it is and how, you know, it's little bits and flashes of stuff. Who would get a straight hour on television these days? It's almost inconceivable. So, you know, Bill wanted to take on liberals and left-wingers, and he wanted to beat them. But honor only comes from beating worthy opponents. So you had to have people who you thought were capable and well-spoken, and you had to let them speak, and then you duked it out. So it was both a very aggressive stance, but it also let an issue get thrashed out, and this was just enormously compelling to me.
And since you mentioned it, here is, and since it's on YouTube also, here is about a minute of William Buckley and Gore Vidal. Oh, I guess this is, I'm sorry, this is about 20 seconds of William Buckley and Gore Vidal debating. I guess this was at the Democratic convention or during
68.
It in Chicago in 1968.
I know you don't
as
care.
As far as I'm concerned, the only sort of pro or crypto Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that,
Let's stop calling me a crypto Nazi. Let's stop calling names. And you'll stay plastered.
Gentlemen,
Well, that was an outlier, okay?
Buckley called him a queer there.
Pardon me?
Buckley called him a queer there,
yes,
didn't he?
Yes, he did. Indeed, he did. And Vidal had called him a crypto-Nazi. So tempers were flaring on both sides of that encounter. And that was an outlier. Bill typically did not lose his temper. He kept his cool. This is what made him attractive to me as a teenager. And attractive all the years I worked with him at National Review. And it was enormously compelling to be working with a man like that, and especially since when I was 23 years old, I went to work for the I kept writing for the magazine through high school and college, interned there, then went to work after I graduated. Then a year after that, Bill takes me to lunch and says, "You're going to be my heir. When I step down at age 65 in 1990, you're going to have the helm of the magazine and you're going to own it."
And how old were you when he said that to you?
23. It was, you know, it was like being taken up to see the kingdoms of the world. You know, here they are. And I was, blown away, thrilled, but also stunned. And so for the next 9 years of my life, this seemed to be my program, my track. And then I got a letter from Bill. I came back one day after lunch to my desk, and it was a confidential letter. Bill was out of town, and he said, "You're not going to succeed me. You have no executive ability." And that was that. So I found that my idol, as idols usually do, they're people. They're human. Bill had changed his mind. I think he was right, by the way. I was better off being a writer than being an editor of a magazine. But certainly the way he conveyed this decision was quite a shock. And the thing is, I was looking for an idol. He was looking for an heir. And you never find those things exactly in the way you set out to look for them. Right. So after that shock, we had to then, over the next many years, find a way to be friends, find a way to relate to each other as we actually were. And that's the second half of the book, the working out of that relationship in real terms rather than fantasy terms.
Richard Brookhiser, my guest on WNYC, his new book, Right Time, Right Place, Coming of Age with William Buckley Jr. and the Conservative Movement. So in that second half of your relationship, was it about getting through the personal discomfort of having been anointed and then rejected that way, or were you also working through issues? Did you wind up diverging at all on issues?
Not diverging on issues. What I did diverge on was interests. Instead of writing solely about the politics of the 20th century, I began going back to the politics of the 18th century. I discovered the Founding Fathers. I discovered that I had things to say about them because they have so much to say to us. And I started, by now I've written 7 books about the founders. My first was called Rediscovering George Washington. And I'm just beginning a book on James Madison, so it goes on. But it was a way of stepping not away from what I was doing, but expanding the circle of it, going back from our contemporary problems and our contemporary issues to some of the sources of our politics, both of our weaknesses and also of our strengths, and trying to understand those. And that was something I could never have done if I had stayed at Bill's side, walking in his shoes. He was a very productive man. He wrote over 50 books. But rarely was he able to give himself the chance to step back and do things that took a long view of whatever his subject was. And he, in a way, he gave me the freedom to do that, even though he did it in a rather rough and graceless fashion.
Buckley died last year, and at least according to one account I read, he seemed to think that the conservative movement, as he knew it, had, I think the quote was that it committed suicide on the issue of the Iraq War. Did he say something like that?
Well, he became very negative about the Iraq War, certainly by 2005. 2005, 2006, he saw it as a bad thing and a hopeless thing, and that we should leave. We'd done as much as we could. We should get out. When the surge began in 2007, he decided that should be supported. And the last editorial conference of his life, he told the directors that the struggle against Islamic terrorism was the struggle of the next era, even as the struggle against communism had been for the bulk of his life. So his views changed, they modified, He certainly was very down in the Iraq War, and the support of the surge was in a way trying to save a bad situation, but he did support it.
We have about a minute left. He had opposed the landmark 1964 Civil Rights Act. He was for states' rights in the segregated South. He came to reject that position.
Yes, he did. I think one of the factors was the influence of Harry Jaffa, a longtime contributor to National Review, the man who wrote The Extremism in Defense of Liberty is No Vice line for Barry Goldwater in 64. But Harry Jaffa is a great student of Thomas Jefferson and Abraham Lincoln, and he argues that the Declaration of Independence is the seminal document of the Revolution and of American history. And, of course, if you believe that, you must believe that all men are created equal. And that, I think, helped undermine Bill's acceptance of segregation.
And in 15 seconds, if you can do this in 15 seconds, liberals would say, gee, conservatives are always for yesterday's civil rights movement.
Well, we've also been for liberating millions of people around the world in communist countries and also in Afghanistan and Iraq from the tyrants there.
The last word. Richard Brookhiser's new book is Right Time, Right Place, Coming of Age with William F. Buckley, Jr. and the Conservative Movement. Rick, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.